From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. We are learning about apparent mistakes made as the Uvalde, Texas school shooting unfolded this week. Mistakes that may have cost lives. The shooter entered the school through a door that had been propped open. And the officer in charge held off on breaching the locked classroom door as children inside dialed 911. Colonel Stephen McGraw heads the Texas Department of Public Safety.
Hey, from the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was a wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that.
And lest we forget one massacre for another, today, three more victims of the racist shooting at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, will be laid to rest. This was also the week 2 years ago that a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for nearly 10 minutes, sparking mass protests. But so far, no significant changes to the law. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Tolu Onarunapa is a Washington Post reporter whose new book is called His Name is George Floyd. Tolu, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Yeah, and Jesse Holland, weekend host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Jesse, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So look, it's been a difficult week in a difficult month, and frankly, a couple difficult years. But I do want to start by having you both reflect on what questions you've been asking yourself over the last few days about where we are as a country right now. And Jesse, why don't you go first?
Well, I mean, it seems ridiculous that we're even having this conversation again. I mean, we've talked about mass shootings in the United States for almost the entirety of my life. And it seems to only be getting worse. And our elected officials have proven over and over that they don't intend on doing anything about this. And therefore, I really just don't know what answers we have, because until we get the availability of so many guns in the wrong hands under control, there doesn't seem to be an answer to all of these unnecessary deaths we have in the United States right now.
Tolu, do you have any answers to the questions you're asking yourself?
I'm continuing to ask a number of questions, including why are we the only country in the world that deals with this on such a regular basis? Just in the course of a couple of weeks, a mass shooting in Buffalo taking 10 lives, a mass shooting in Texas taking 21 lives, including so many young children. And the question is, what will it take for us to change this? What will it take for us to step in and say enough is enough? What will it take for us to remember that 2 years ago, George Floyd was killed by a police officer and it sparked massive protests, unlike we've never seen in quite a long time? We don't see those kinds of protests even after these mass shootings. But despite even the protests that we saw 2 years ago, we haven't seen the kind of major systemic change that people were calling for. So the question is, what will it take for lawmakers to actually listen to the people and actually make the changes that are called for?
Well, Jesse, we're just getting more information from Uvalde, Texas, about what appear to be mistakes from the authorities there. And that, of course, impacts our public conversation on mass shootings. Some argue for hardening schools, and others, of course, are talking about regulating guns and access. How does this event, what we're learning about this event, you think, affect the national debate?
Well, we're seeing opening up a new front in our conversations about mass shootings, and that is about the actions of police. Beforehand, we would talk about the shooter, we would talk about the gun stores, we would talk about whether schools have enough security. Now we're beginning to talk about the actions of the police. Now, I'm really hoping that some of the stories that I'm hearing out of Texas are not true about the police getting their children out and then refusing to allow other parents to get their children out. I'm hoping I'm not hearing, these stories are not correct about police not taking action when these people are being killed while they're standing outside. But it is opening up a conversation about the police and how they treat the communities they are supposed to protect. Firefighters know that when their job is to put themselves in danger and save as many lives as they can. If police don't think that's their job, I think we need to rethink the whole concept of policing in the United States. So I think we're going to see a conflating now of us talking about the police and their actions, just as we did with the George Floyd and other deaths of other African Americans in these communities. We're now going to see a new conversation.
We might have just lost Jesse. Lost there.
Jesse, but he was leading up totally to my question for you is, do you think we are seeing kind of a merging of this conversation about police conduct in Uvalde and, of course, police conduct 2 years after George Floyd?
There is an interesting merging. We have seen, a number of conservatives and people that have been standing up for police after some of these racial justice protests now start to ask questions about why the police in Texas were not more proactive in saving lives and what we need to do to change the way policing is done in the aftermath of these mass shootings. It's part of a process of, taking the light away from the issue of guns and the potential laws that need to be changed on making sure that there's more gun safety. Shining the light on what the police did and shining the light on whether they should have done more is something that we're now hearing from not only Democrats, but also Republicans who don't want to engage in some of the debate over gun laws. They're saying if the police would have stepped up, if the police would have been stronger, if we would have hardened the schools and maybe had more police in some of these schools, then maybe, more lives would have been saved. So we are seeing a really interesting coalition come together, as some Democrats and some progressives are saying, maybe we shouldn't lionize police so much because of what they do to people like George Floyd. Now we're seeing some Republicans who had been the defenders of police say, maybe we should scrutinize the way policing is done and the way that police respond to these mass shootings.
Okay, so speaking of gun policy, I want to spend a few moments now talking about that. I'm going to play a few pieces of tape. I want to start with Ted Cruz. Here's Republican Ted Cruz of Texas, of course, being pressed by a reporter from Sky News in the UK.
The proposals the Democrats have, none of them would have stopped this.
But why does this only happen in your country? I really think that's what many people around the world just, they cannot fathom. Why only in America? Why is this American exceptionalism so awful?
You know, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful.
I think this aspect of it.
You get your political agenda.
No, it's honestly.
Okay, so that was the Republican side. Here's the Democrats, Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy.
Why do you spend all this time running for the United States Senate? Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority? If your answer is that as this slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing.
Both of you gentlemen spend a lot of time covering Congress and lawmakers. What do you think of both of these pieces of tape, starting with this idea that the U.S. Senate doesn't seem interested in legislating on this particular issue? Jesse, start with you.
Well, I've watched the Senate since the year 2000, and I can predict confidently right now that there will be no major gun legislation coming out of the U.S. Senate this year, next year, or the year after that, simply because there aren't the votes for it. The NRA and other gun rights groups continually pump money into their favorite candidates to block this type of legislation, whether those candidates are Republican or Democrat. Until there are more senators, and that number, by the way, is not 50, the number has to be 60. Until there are 60 senators in the U.S. Senate who are willing to take on major gun legislation, there will be no change coming out of Congress. So right now there are not 60. I don't see there being 60 after the midterms. I don't see there being 60 after 2024. Until there are a filibuster-proof majority of senators in the U.S. Senate and a president willing to sign major gun legislation, nothing's going to change. All of it is just hot air, and I think that's what we're going to see for the foreseeable future.
Tolu, it's not just guns, is it? 2 years after George Floyd was murdered, nothing has really happened to improve that situation in this country. It's not just guns. It's almost every big issue that you can think of.
That's exactly right. The polarization in our Congress has been so stark that it's very hard to get things done, even after an emergency. The COVID pandemic was one exception where we did see some laws be passed as a result of the fact that we were in the middle of a pandemic and money was able to be provided. But even after George Floyd was killed and his murder set off the biggest protest that we've seen in a generation, and it touched every part of our country, it touched conservative states and conservative districts as well as liberal states and districts, lawmakers did not respond to the kind of policing bill that was required and requested by a number of the people taking to the streets. Now, President Biden this week did sign an executive order, but that's a sign of how limited our congressional abilities have been in terms of responding to crises. And when it comes to gun laws and gun safety and these mass shootings, which happens to be a crisis that we see over and over again, it does not appear that Congress is willing to stand up and solve or at least address that crisis in any kind of bipartisan way. Polarization is the poison that is keeping us from being able to get things done on major issues in this country.
Tolu Olorunapa is a Washington Post reporter. His book is His Name is George Floyd. And Jesse Holland is weekend host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thanks to you both. When the U.S. and China began reconnecting in the early 70s, Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's national security advisor, made a secret trip there. American ping pong players flew over, as did a leading American orchestra. And a new book tells the story of the Philadelphia Orchestra's groundbreaking trip to China in 1973. That is when Western music was banned there. And the Chinese audience went wild when conductor Eugene Ormandy led the finale, Stars and Stripes Forever. The book Beethoven in Beijing is a companion to a 2021 documentary of the same name. And we have the author and co-director of the film with us, Jennifer Lin. For many years, covered China for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jennifer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks for having me on.
So your book and film tell a long history between the Philadelphia Orchestra and China, going all the way back to China's opening to the modern world and Chairman Mao's meeting with Richard Nixon in 1972. Here's a piece of sound from Nicholas Platt, a U.S. State Department official at the time.
We had a kind of a ragtag ping pong team. The Chinese invited them to come, and that was a signal. They wanted a cultural element in the relationship, and the Philadelphia Orchestra was part of that.
So, Jennifer, you're from Philadelphia. Do you know this history? Because I didn't. A lot of us have heard about ping pong diplomacy. I had not heard about Philadelphia Orchestra diplomacy.
So I was a correspondent in China in the 1990s. And to be honest with you, I didn't realize the extent of the popularity of the Philadelphia Orchestra until later. 2008, the newspaper, I worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they sent me to China to cover a concert of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And it was covering that concert to mark the 35th anniversary of this historic tour that it really kind of struck me, the nostalgia that many Chinese had for this orchestra in particular.
Mm. And so you start embarking on this project, this documentary film and this book. And as you tell it, there was pressure back in 1973 for the Philadelphia Orchestra not to go. I mean, I could see it now, right? How dare you cavort with the evil Chinese? Because this would have been a betrayal of Taiwan, the American ally. And they go over, and this is really interesting. They play Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, and it turns out the conductor, Ormandy, hates that symphony, but Mao's wife, known as Madame Mao or Jiang Qing, she makes it happen. She requests it. And this is interesting because the Philadelphia Orchestra didn't bring the sheet music. So as you tell the story, Chinese officials bring sheet music that they have from Beijing and from Shanghai. And some of the Philadelphia musicians remembered what it looked like.
It was a big jumble of scores that came in.
The parts that we got didn't have our normal markings in them, the bowings and things like that.
Everyone was individually handwritten, was full of mistakes. And we would be playing along and, oh, wrong note.
That's one of my favorite stories from the trip in 1973, because it was, you know, it was this big kerfuffle between Ormondy and Madame Mao. So Ormondy didn't like the six because he felt it didn't show off the orchestra enough. So he came prepared to play the fifth. They went back and forth, and finally Nick Platt, the diplomat, was able to persuade Ormondy that basically if he didn't go along that this could in some way jeopardize U.S.-China relations. One of the musicians told me that although the scores were all handwritten and there were a lot of mistakes, this, of course, is the Philadelphia Orchestra, and basically they could have played Beethoven with their eyes closed.
Now, 1973 was, as we know, still in the middle of China's Cultural Revolution, right, when the ideology was of purity, to smash what they call the four olds, right, the Sijiu, including, surely, Western classical music. So when these Americans from Philadelphia came, that must have been a moment in China.
It was huge. And it was huge news, too. I mean, it was front page news in the People's Daily. And the people who were able to go to the concerts, they never forgot it. Interestingly, Scott, a cousin of mine who was a pianist in Shanghai, she was had gone to the Shanghai Conservatory. Her career was interrupted, though, during the Cultural Revolution, and she was sent to the countryside. But she got a ticket. She told me many years later, she said, you know, being able to hear this music that they were forbidden from playing, it was outlawed. She said hearing it was like being in the desert and getting a long drink of water. So the tour left a lasting impression on many, many people.
Yeah. And you quote someone in your film saying this sparked Beethoven fever in China. What impact do you think this had on the nature of classical music, both in China and in the U.S., this flourishing relationship that began in the 70s?
Well, the impact has been on both sides, really. In China, you know, the Beethoven fever that took hold really took off in like the 1980s. And for a couple of reasons, there was a lot of pent-up demand. People could only have one child, so they would lavish that one child with things like music lessons. But the impact has also been worldwide because it's creating new audience. Really, every top-tier orchestra in the world now includes Shanghai and Beijing on their world tour schedules. And what we're seeing now in the United States is many, many top-tier American orchestras include Chinese musicians in their ranks. But what we're seeing now is also many Chinese orchestras coming and touring in the United States and many Chinese composers whose music is being enjoyed here.
You know, Jennifer, as I hear you describe that, I think about, I have a cousin in Shanghai also, and he grew up and spent his life there. And he kind of embodies this new generation. He plays in a community orchestra. He plays clarinet. He has a fancy road bike that's nicer than mine. I mean, he's kind of the modern person. And he's told me several times, you know, you Americans talk a lot about what's being closed off in China, the political speech being closed off, the internet freedom being closed off, which is true. But then he says, don't forget everything else that is opening up here, doing sports and camping and theater and food and fashion, right? Don't get me started on Chinese people and hair and music. So in a way, is your book, is your film directly or indirectly kind of making this point?
Absolutely. It's kind of hard for Americans to kind of wrap their minds around this idea that a certain form of music would be banned. But it was only a generation ago. It was only in 1973 that people like my cousin, your cousin, they were just not allowed to even listen to Beethoven, let alone perform it. And now today, when you look at the situation, it's just mind-boggling. When I was doing the documentary, I traveled three times with the Philadelphia Orchestra and once with the Curtis Institute. And when you go to a concert in China, the audience, it's very diverse. You see a lot of families. You see a lot of young couples. So it's there's real interest. So when you think about it, back in 1973, this was just unheard of, and it was only a few you know, the Philadelphia Orchestra did 6 concerts, so there were only a couple hundred people maybe who actually heard them. But now every big city has these amazing concert halls. There are millions of children learning instruments and attending conservatories. So yes, I mean, if you look at the music world in China, it presents that astounding example of how things have changed in only a generation.
Jennifer, finally, I wonder if there's a personal takeaway that you have from this project. Your previous book focused on your family history and Christianity in China, and some of your relatives suffered dearly for their faith during the Cultural Revolution, and you know, our families have similar stories, yours and mine. But this is an entirely kind of different lens to look at China. And I just wonder, what do you take away as a person?
Yeah, I mean, this project has been a real journey for me. And as I mentioned before, you know, my cousin from Shanghai, she really suffered during the Cultural Revolution. So she had been at the Shanghai Conservatory when the Cultural Revolution started. And there was one night, you know, where the Red Guards came to the family home and they took away her piano, they burned her true sheet music, they broke all of her Deutsche Grammophon albums. And then, you know, a few months later, she was caught playing Mozart one night. And the next day, the Red Guards tried to break her hands with a ping pong paddle. So, I mean, to see the way things have changed and the way people are now able to enjoy this music, really, it was a revelation to me, but it's also been kind of reassuring that, you know, despite all the, you know, the bumps in the relationship between the United States and China, at least we have music.
Well, on that note, let's go out listening to some more of the Philadelphia Orchestra from 1973, playing the Yellow River Concerto, which was composed by the Central Philharmonic Society in China. Jennifer Lin is a former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter, and her book is Beethoven in Beijing, and she co-directed the film of the same name. Jennifer, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott. It was fun being on your show.
For a lot of workers, the recent good news about the economy has been higher wages. Maybe you noticed this yourself. Paychecks have ticked up a bit after staying mostly flat for more than a generation. But now, there are some signs that wage growth has peaked. Mike Regan is senior editor of Bloomberg News, and he is with us now. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
So after 40 years of mostly tepid wage growth, this joyride didn't last very long, did it? What's happening? What are you seeing out there?
You know, Peter, I think it's helpful to think of this in similar terms to all the supply chain chaos we've all dealt with since the pandemic. In other words, when the economy reopened after the worst of the pandemic, there was a big mismatch in supply and demand for jobs. There were just way too many jobs than there were people looking to fill those jobs. So that's caused wages to go up pretty significantly. Average hourly earnings in April were up about 5.5%. That's more than twice the rate of change on average in the decade before. So like everything else, now that the world is hopefully getting more back to normal and things are normalizing further, the thinking is that those hot wage gains of 5.5% will come back to something closer towards the historical average, which was, again, about half of that.
I guess I should say that 5% wage growth or something more than that is still below the rate of inflation. So it's still tough for workers. On the other hand, maybe this isn't all so bad because the Fed and Wall Street have this fear of something called the wage price spiral, meaning that if wages keep going up really fast, inflation keeps going up too. Can you help us explain that?
Yeah, it's basically, if you think about it, if we're all dealing with higher prices for groceries and anything else we buy in our day-to-day life, we're going to start asking for bigger raises at our workplace. And then, well, companies are going to raise their prices even further to compensate for the higher wages they're paying out. And it kind of causes like a feedback loop between wages and consumer prices that can get out of control, why they call it a spiral. So for the Federal Reserve, They're kind of looking at the cooling down in wages as a good thing that will sort of help prevent that. And as a result, they can perhaps, if that happens, be a little less aggressive with the interest rate increases that they've been doing, because that's really their main tool for combating very strong inflation is to raise interest rates. And that obviously can have all sorts of headwinds to the economy and to corporate earnings, which explains, you know, Peter, why the stock market has been so weak this year.
Could there be a coexistence or a balance that would allow the Fed to bring, or that would, you know, that where wages could come up without sparking inflation? Like, is there any way to do that?
Yeah, and that's historically in normal economic times that aren't as, you know, goofy, for lack of a better word, as this, that's kind of been the case. You know, you want a little bit of inflation in a strong economy. Falling prices or deflation is a much bigger issue. So the Fed's goal has always been 2% for inflation. They actually struggled to get it that high before the pandemic, and that's why they kept interest rates so low. And historically, average hourly earnings have been a little bit higher than that, you know, less than 1% higher than what the inflation rate was. So that explains why it never quite felt like everyone was getting a big booming raise in their paycheck. But wages were increasing a little bit higher than inflation. And that is kind of, you know, the ideal economic scenario that they're trying to get back to.
We're going to leave it right there. Mike Regan, thanks so much.
The National Rifle Association convention starts today in Houston, about 275 miles from the site of the deadly mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Former President Trump is delivering a keynote address today, and Texas Governor Greg Abbott will send his remarks by video. Let's take a deeper look at the NRA with NPR's Tim Mak, author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So a lot going on today. Several big-name Republican musicians say they won't go, Don McLean, Larry Gatlin. But this raises some broad questions about the NRA that you have written about in your book. I mean, the title of your book is Downfall because of huge problems on the inside. Power struggles, dubious finances, an inquiry by the New York Attorney General. How strong is the NRA really, internally and externally?
I think without a doubt, the NRA is facing the most serious challenges it's faced in its 150-year history. There have been revolts on the board. There have been all these public airings of evidence about misconduct and mismanagement, tens of millions of dollars spent by top executives at the NRA on things like lavish vacations and private jets and ridiculous meals and sweetheart deals for insiders with contracts in the millions and millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so they're really struggling, financially struggling. Fundraising is down. Their spending is down from its peak. But they retain a lot of power, and they continue to retain a lot of influence among what matters most when it comes to this sort of grassroots politics, and that is the ability to mobilize its millions and millions of members in moments like this.
And in this moment, after this terrible shooting Tuesday, are we seeing it play out, this political currency on the outside the NRA may still have? Are we seeing lawmakers whose NRA rating really matters to them saying things that are aligned with the NRA? Are we seeing its talking points being repeated by candidates and pundits?
Political influence draws politicians, right? And there's no greater example of that than the fact that former President Donald Trump will be addressing in a keynote address today, the NRA's annual meeting. This is really kind of a comeback party for the NRA and their decision to go ahead with the convention, despite the shootings just a few hours away, is a sign of the NRA's kind of calcification of its position.
Can you remind us of its response that so many people considered this tone-deaf response to Sandy Hook and whether that's relevant this week?
Well, you know, after Sandy Hook, Wayne LaPierre disappeared for a period of time and then reemerged to give a speech in which he advocated for more guns in schools. And that was something that upset a lot of people. I wouldn't be surprised if there were similar proposals made this weekend, that schools should be hardened. I mean, this just goes to show the point we've been talking about, which is that the NRA's messaging has become only more certain over time.
And can you remind us what the message of the NRA, the public message of the NRA has been to this shooting in Uvalde? What have they said publicly?
Well, they've condemned the shooting, and they said that they would be reflective about it. But as they've often done in the past, they take no responsibility for any part of the gun culture in America or this particular shooting. Many NRA supporters have suggested that it's not guns that lead to this, but instead other things such as, you know, social issues like violent video games or other issues that they identify in American society. The NRA is practiced in its messaging playbook.
We spoke to Rob Pincus from a different gun rights organization, the Second Amendment Group, 2AO.org, and he slammed the NRA for feeding this left-right culture war, as he described it, being very unhelpful and actually reducing gun deaths. So I guess the question for you is, are there new voices, important voices, among gun rights supporters that may over time change the conversation, perhaps reduce the volume and the effectiveness of the NRA?
Well, you know, there are quite a number of Second Amendment advocates like Rob Pincus who don't want the NRA to be, like you say, in shambles. And they are critical of the organization while being supportive of the underlying gun policy issue. And what's interesting is that these folks who are demanding additional accountability and transparency in the organization, they represent a relatively small percentage, but a vocal percentage of the NRA's membership. It remains to be seen whether or not folks who are challenging the NRA's leadership will succeed in compelling change inside their organization.
So I'm just trying to understand, how might the conversation change among gun rights supporters if some of these other groups or even people internally at the NRA have more of a voice? Might the rhetoric, might the policy talking points change, evolve? Is that happening? Might that be happening?
I don't think that that's in the cards in the short term. That what we've seen is, rather than a change in tone, a change in messaging, we've seen, like I was saying, a calcification in the tone and messaging. The NRA is digging in. They're getting more used to kind of executing this playbook because of the sad frequency of these types of events, these mass shootings. Mm.
So I guess the question is, the NRA has had so much influence over the decades. It has seeded these talking points, this rhetoric, this point of view that, you know, if it were to disappear, would its influence continue on for a long time?
The question is the NRA powerful, or is the NRA merely a vehicle for something that exists inside American political culture? And I think, you know, even as we've seen the NRA as an organization struggle, the policy on gun legislation, it just hasn't changed. And so you have to conclude that the NRA is merely a vehicle, and that its real power isn't in its money or its organization or its executives, but instead the millions of members that make up its grassroots, who continue to make themselves heard among the politicians that make these decisions.
And so this weekend in Houston, then, what's important to watch?
Well, Donald Trump is always a wild card. Even though he's popular among the NRA base, he's been someone who's in the past advocated for background checks, to the horror of top NRA leadership. So I'll be curious to know whether he's here to deliver some red meat to the grassroots, or whether he's here with a more sober message in the wake of the shootings. Mm.
That's NPR reporter Tim Mak. His recent book, which is a great read, is Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim, thank you as always.
Thanks so much.
Yesterday was cause for celebration. My kids finished 7th grade and kindergarten. We took a picture in the front yard as we have the past few years, and when I compare what they looked like on the first day of school, my heart grows a size for each of them. But like many Americans, the overwhelming feeling I had this week was of despair. Because again, we have found ourselves asking a question that no parent should ever know the answer to. What if my babies don't come home from school? Our collective despair as a country is not equal to, will never be equal to, the horror that 21 families in Uvalde are feeling today. They woke up on Wednesday morning, and they knew the answer to that awful question. I used to think that my work as a journalist could help in situations like this. I used to think it could break down the barriers that people have when they disagree about something big like guns or abortion or immigration. And I'm not sure about that at all anymore. Instead, I'm left to repeat the same conversations we had after Sandy Hook, after Las Vegas, after San Bernardino, Dayton, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Tucson, El Paso, Orlando. After each of those massacres and countless others, journalists went out and asked the same questions of the same experts. They wrote down the same responses from mostly the same politicians, and they visited a different set of grieving families. How could this happen, we'd ask, as if for the first time. How can it stop? These are questions that I don't want to ask anymore if the answers are never going to come. And how could it be that the only question that's easy to answer is what happens if my baby never comes home from school? I'll never forget the day this week that I read on air the names of the children and teachers who died together in that fourth grade classroom in Uvalde. When the microphone was finally off, I put my head down on the desk and I prayed that my children's name would never be on such a list. I'm afraid that's all that I can do. This is Here and Now.
Three months into the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the information war seems to be tilting decidedly in favor of Ukraine, as far as what turns up on my social media feed. Why? Well, Femi Okey is here with the answer. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Scott.
So we all have seen clips, mostly on the Ukrainian side in our feeds. I'm recalling that video of the seven-year-old girl singing Let It Go from a basement shelter.
Отпусти и забудь, что прошло уже не вернуть. Отпусти и забудь, новый день он кажет путь.
Браво, браво!
You know, Femi, we like to think of social media as organic and grassroots, but
sure.
Is there a broader strategy that you're detecting from the Ukrainian keyboard warriors, as it were?
Right. Well, it's the posts are competent. They're confident. They use social platforms for empathy, support, even humor. Led by a couple of big accounts, the Ukraine official Twitter account recently posted about items as diverse as the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, commemorative stamps for the Ukrainian man who sent a very memorable message to a Russian warship. That phrase is now on a stamp, memes, and then, of course, personal posts. The experience,
huh.
Oh yes, absolutely. The experience of war from a citizen's perspective. And what I'm seeing and feeling is an effort to keep the attention of people outside of Ukraine very firmly on Ukraine, making sure it stays in the headlines.
Yeah, of course, perhaps the central player is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Very prominent. He, of course, is a comedian, a TV figure, knows how to communicate. He has addressed, in the course of this war, the U.S. Congress, the Grammy Awards, the Cannes Film Festival. Here is a video posted online in April.
Ukraine needs weapon supplies. We need heavy artillery, armed vehicles, air defense systems, and combat aircraft. Anything to repel Russian forces and stop their war crimes.
It's such a direct sales pitch. It's basically an ad. In one version, you can see President Zelensky on one side of the screen, and then the list of specific weapons are rotating slowly, like a deadly version of a game show. So Zelensky is a super social media user. He's on Telegram, Facebook, Instagram, Flickr, with his digital team making an impact.
And tell me more about how this to you looks like an ad campaign.
Because President Zelensky is standing, looking straight at the camera and saying, this is what I need. He is using words that are very direct. And then not only saying, I need heavy weapons, which is the title of that video, but then those weapons pop up on the screen. So you can see, if you are an international country who is thinking about sending weapons, President Zelensky doesn't just say, I need weapons. He says exactly the kind of weapons that he needs. That is an ad. It's a direct appeal.
Yeah, to the audience, to an audience he knows. Okay, here's Zelensky again in a video to raise money.
Here, in one click, you can donate funds to protect our defenders, to save our civilians, and to rebuild Ukraine.
That is from the United 24. It's a fundraising platform launched to support Ukraine by Ukraine. And here's where I'm seeing the strategy here, Scott. I spent several hours just going through all of the website posts of President Zelensky since February the 24th.
Yeah.
Here's a couple of clues as to what he and his digital team are trying to do. He says, being brave is our brand. We will spread our courage in the world. In another address, Ukraine became a hero for the whole free world. Another address, we are working to make the whole world friends of Ukraine. It's not a secret message. It's a very clear message where the president of Ukraine is saying, we are using these addresses, these speeches, these appeals to grab your attention, world, and not forget where we are, what is happening, and how you can help.
Yeah. Well, finally, let me ask you about the Russian side. I mean, Russia has a reputation and a history of being very skilled at messaging, social media, misinformation. We remember the meddling in our own election in 2016. Mm-hmm. What happened to the Moscow social media machine?
It's working very well for Russians. There are many Russians who do not believe that there is a real war in Ukraine. They have relatives in Ukraine. They argue with their relatives in Ukraine. So working really well inside Russia. But outside of Russia, we know very well that Russia is really good at propaganda. What we've seen with our own eyes doesn't tally with the story, the narrative that Russia is telling. So Russia's propaganda works within Russia, but not outside of Russia. And that is why Ukraine, in terms of social media, is actually having a very big impact and a long impact that's gone beyond the first few weeks of the Ukraine war.
All right, that's Febi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.